going to look at Genesis tonight. Genesis has 50 chapters, so we're going to have to move to get through all of them. We may not make it. We may have to go half of it just to hit one verse in each one. But just a little bit of background first. The word Genesis comes from the Hebrew word, and I'll pronounce this as close as I can, Bereshit. And that is the first word in the Bible, in the Hebrew language. The first word. And it actually means in the beginning. And that's, of course, what the first verse says, in the beginning. And that defines something about the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is all about beginnings, all about firsts. If you think about it, as you read through the book of Genesis, you run upon first after first after first. You have the first reference to time. So you have the beginning of time. You have the beginning of the universe, the beginning of earth, the beginning of life. You have the first marriage, the first man, the first woman, the first child. All of these things, and on, the first sin, the first murder, the first case of bigamy, on and on, all through the book of Genesis. It seems like everything that's happening is, this is the first time these things are happening. And so, that's the key to the book of Genesis. It's all about the first. It's all about the beginning. And that, in fact, is the title of the book. I want to give you a real brief outline of the book of Genesis. The first 11 chapters, chapters 1 through 11, are a history of the primitive world, we might call it. The world before the law of Moses, before even the patriarchs. This is very early in the history of the world. Realize, too, that there are 50 chapters in Genesis. One book out of 39 in the Old Testament. But this book of Genesis covers over half of the time covered in the Old Testament. About 2,000 years of the 4,000, give or take a few years, from creation to Christ are in Genesis. Well, let me tell you, God wasn't spending a whole lot of excess time adding things in. I mean, he's just running out there. So there are so many things because of that, because he's trying to squeeze so much information, 2,000 years of history, into a book that's 50 chapters long, that's only about 70 pages in my Bible, might be even less than that in yours, because my Bible has two different translations in it. And it's 70 pages, so maybe 30 or 40 pages, just not a very long book. And yet it covers 2,000 years of history. Try to find a secular history book that covers 2,000 years in 60 pages. They've got to write long paragraphs about every little insignificant event. But God was rushing through that. Because of that, he didn't deal with every detail. Shamika was asking me some questions about some things in Genesis, like that one of her professors had brought up to try to debunk the Bible. Like, well, where did Cain get his wife? There wasn't anybody but Adam and Eve and Cain. Cain had killed Abel. Where did Cain get his wife? Well, so many times people fail to understand that the Bible doesn't tell every detail. The Bible says that Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters. And it doesn't tell when they had those other sons and daughters. It just says that they had other sons and daughters. So we know that there were some other people there for Cain, women for Cain to choose one as his wife. Obviously had to have been his sister. But there are a lot of things like that people miss out on. So here we have the history. In chapters 1 and 2, the creation. Chapters 3 through 6, the fall of man. And boy, did they fall a long way. From chapter 3, the beginning of chapter 3, when they're there in the garden and have fellowship with God, all the way to chapter 6, when God is ready to destroy the whole lot of them because of their wickedness. They fell from having no sin to the point where God says every thought every imagination of their heart with evil continually. Think about that. You know some wicked people, probably. I know I've met some wicked people. But I guarantee you, even the most wicked people we've met, not every thought that they have is wicked. There are times when they aren't thinking evil thoughts. But the world had gotten so bad that everybody in the world was doing nothing but thinking evil continually. That's pretty bad. No wonder God couldn't put up with it any longer. Then we see chapter 7 and 8, the flood, and then chapters 9 through 11, the new world, or the world after the flood. Not really a new world, it was the same world, but it had been cleansed. Then chapters 12 through 50 is the history of the patriarchs. And by the patriarchs, we speak of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And if you want to lump Joseph in there as well, because he takes up a large section of this book. From the beginning to the flood, it's about 1,500 years. And then from the flood to Abraham, a few hundred more years. Covered in the blink of an eye, just in a matter of verses, it covers the time from Noah to Abraham. We see Abraham's life and the promise, the covenant that God makes with Abraham in chapters 12 through 25, and we're not going to get into the details of that. Then we see the life of Isaac and how the covenant passed on to him in chapters 21 through 26, and you have a little bit of overlap there because of the fact that Isaac was Abraham's son. And then the life of Isaac, the life of Jacob, rather, as the covenant continues to be the major factor in the book of Genesis, chapters 27 through 36. And then Joseph's life, as we see some of the promises made to Abraham coming true in the life of Joseph. Some of those things already coming into play, the promises that God has made. And that is chapter 37 through 50. Now, very quickly, we're going to look at one verse. And I tell you, it is tough to get just one verse. You might want to go through and look at and see. You'll probably find lots of other verses. I just picked one verse out of each chapter. In Genesis chapter 1, we have to go with verse 1. I mean, this is one of the biggest verses in the Bible in some ways, because if it hadn't been there, we wouldn't be here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He started it all and began His creation. So, Genesis chapter 1, we have verse 1. In Genesis chapter 2, I pick verse 24. Here we have the first marriage, the first relationship between man and woman, and we see God honoring that relationship. In verse 24, we see Adam say, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." And right there, Adam and God both agree on the process for the marriage relationship and the way that men and women should live together. And they establish that. In chapter 3, no other verse other than 15 could possibly be the most important in that chapter. Verse 15, God promises the woman and the serpent as He's speaking to them after Adam and Eve's first sin, "And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." The first prophecy about Christ. A prophecy that a descendant of the woman is going to crush Satan's head. Or to bruise Satan's head. The first prophecy of Christ. Then chapter 4. I don't know if this is the most significant verse. Certainly the chapter 4 is where Cain killed Abel. And there are other things going on there. But I picked verse 26, the last verse, because I think this is a significant verse. And then to Seth. Seth, of course, was Adam's son who took the place, really, of Abel after Cain killed Abel. And to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. And then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. That's significant. Even though Adam and Eve had talked with God, apparently something happened in that next generation that all of their children, it seems, other than Abel, who was killed, all of their children, it seems, were being faithful to God. When Seth comes along, and when Seth then has his own son, you've got a whole generation of people there that have turned away from God. But when Seth has his son, then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. And of course, the significance of that birth. Sometimes it takes becoming a parent for us to start thinking about important things, for us to start becoming responsible and care about what's really important in life. Then chapter 5. Chapter 5, we want to pick out verse 24. What a great example is verse 24. It says, "And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him." The first, and in fact, one of only two individuals in the Bible who didn't die. He didn't die. He walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What an example to us all. Wouldn't it be nice? What a goal to have, to try to live a life so good that you don't have to die. You can just skip that death and go right on to heaven. Wouldn't that be nice? As much as we worry and think about death and not wanting to die, Enoch didn't have to worry about it. He walked with God and he just walked right on into heaven. He didn't have to die. What a wonderful thing that would be. What an example he sets for us. Wish we knew more about his life, about what he did and how he lived. But again, because of the fact that Genesis is trying to cover so much in so little, that's all we really know about him, is about who his father was, who his son was, and how long he lived. That's about all we know about Enoch. A couple other references to him in the New Testament and other places. Chapter 6. Here we are, just 4 chapters. From the end of chapter 1, when God says, saw everything and said, it is very good, till now, chapter 6 and verse 6. It repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. That's how fast it got bad. So that if God was such that he was sorry he ever made man. And because of that, of course, he sent a flood. Which brings us to chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse number 1. For any of you who have ever heard Brother Bert Thompson talk about the first few chapters of Genesis, chapter 7 and verse 1 is a key verse, and he focuses in on it a lot, and I will too. The Lord said unto Noah, "Come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation." We see here Noah, God saw him as righteous. But what's more, focus on what God says. Come thou into the ark. God doesn't say, you go over there and get in that boat. But God invites Noah to come into the ark with him. Some of the modern translations have changed that to say, go into the ark. But that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says, come into the ark. God was going to share that boat ride with Noah and his family. God was inviting them in. Again, clear evidence to us that if we live righteous lives, we will have fellowship with God. Same thing the New Testament writers tell us, but we see it playing out here in the Old Testament in these narrative stories. And in this case, the case of Noah and his ark. But God says, come into the ark, you and your family. Then chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 20. After the flood, Noah could have done a lot of things. He could have pouted because all of his friends were dead. He could have looked at all the destruction around. There had to have been, if you've ever seen a place after there's been a flood, I mean, there's logs and limbs and trash and all sorts. sorts of things all over, everywhere. All kinds of rubble and debris, and there are rivers where there weren't rivers, and there are all sorts of things all over the place because of the flood, the waters. So Noah could have griped about all these things, but instead, chapter 8 and verse 20, Noah builded an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. He came down off of that ark. He didn't gripe and complain about the mess he had to clean up and how he had to start all over and build a new house and all that kind of thing. The first thing he did when he got off that boat was build an altar and worship God. He didn't waste any time about it. That's one of the reasons God picked him, because he wasn't one that was going to waste a whole lot of time with foolish endeavors, but he was going to be one who would worship God. Then chapter 9, we have, it's one sentence, but it covers two verses, 12 and 13. God said, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth." God makes the covenant that he will never again flood the world, and he sets his token of that covenant. Every time God has a covenant with the people, there's a token involved. There's something to see or to do. There's something involved that shows that covenant. Every time it clouds up to rain, we see, well, maybe not every time, but most of the time when it clouds up to rain, we see a rainbow, either before or during or after the rainstorm. We see that rainbow, and it reminds us that God's never going to flood the whole world again. Doesn't mean he won't flood local places, but he's never going to flood the whole world and destroy the whole world again by that flood. Then, chapter 10. Chapter 10, verses 9 and 10. Talking about the man Nimrod. It says, "He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar." Here we have the first kingdom, the first earthly government. First time where a man decides that he will rule. We're going to see, we see also in chapter 11 what happens as a result of that. The human government has an existence. Human government is a rebellion against the authority of God. It says God is not wise enough or powerful enough or whatever to govern us, so we will govern ourselves. That's what human government is saying in essence. Chapter 11, we see what happens here. Chapter 11, verse 4 is the key verse. "And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." Now, if you notice back in verse 2 that this is in the land of Shinar, which is where Nimrod established his kingdom. And they decide they're going to build a tower up to heaven, they're going to make a name for themselves, and the last part of that verse, "lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth." If you go back to chapter 9, just after the flood, God tells them to be scattered and replenish the earth. They violate a direct command. He told them, spread out, replenish the earth. Scatter yourselves over the whole face of the earth. But instead they say, we better build a city and make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered on the earth. Doing exactly the opposite of what God has told them to do. Just a few short generations after Noah, already the downward slide is beginning again. Then chapter 12. Chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, the promise that God makes. "And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee," he's talking to Abraham here, "and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curses thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. God makes that promise to Abraham, that all of the families of the earth are going to be blessed through Abraham and through his family. Then chapter 13, verse number 15, here again, God speaking to Abraham. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. Never guess where Abraham was standing at the time God told him that. Standing in the land of Canaan when God told him that. He said, look around to north, south, east, west. All this land you see, I'm going to give it to you, and I'm going to give it to your descendants after you. The land of Canaan, which is where the Israelites wind up going later on. We're getting ahead of ourselves, and we don't want to get too much away too soon. We want to be surprised when we get there. We'll find out all these things out. Chapter 14. Chapter 14, verses 18 through 20. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him, that's Abraham, and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand, and he gave him tithes of all. It's interesting, if we looked over to the New Testament, we'd find out that this priest is a very important character. We wouldn't think of it just reading along, because this is the only place he's mentioned in the Old Testament. He's a very important character when it comes time for Jesus to begin his priestly reign. Because Jesus is not of the tribe of Levi, which is where the priests come from. And the priests have to come from the tribe of Levi under the Mosaic law. So if Jesus is going to be a priest and he's not of the tribe of Levi, he's got to have somewhere else to look to be a priest. Here it is. Melchizedek was a priest of God before Levi was even born, before Levi's father was even born, before Levi's father, his grandfather was even born. And right here, there's already a priesthood of God in the Old Testament. Also, we see that Melchizedek blessed Abram. The Bible tells us that without doubt, without contradiction, the less is blessed of the greater. The person who is greater is the one who does the blessing on the person who is not so great. And here we have Melchizedek, a priest of God, blessing Abraham. He thought Abraham was the best character in the whole, he thought he was the big, no. Here's some stranger, we don't even know about him. We don't even know where he came from. We don't know who his parents are or any of that. And yet he is blessing Abraham. And the Bible says, the less is blessed by the greater. So Abraham is blessed by Melchizedek. Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. And we don't even know where he came from. So, and that'll be important later on in the book of Genesis as well. Chapter 15. Verses 13 through 16, and this is a long section, but it's a big promise. Here's what, and a prophecy as well. Here again, God speaking to Abraham. He said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. God here prophesies to Abraham of the enslavement that is going to be of the children of Israel in Egypt. Right there, in those four verses, that little segment. Chapter 16. And verse 16. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abraham. To Abram. Abram was 86 years old when Ishmael was born. The Israelites always claimed, Abraham is our father. So was Ishmael. We see, though, the results, if we look more in depth than we are, we see the results of what happens when we disobey God and go against His plan. Hagar was not Abraham's wife. Sarah was. God didn't want Abraham going having a child by another woman. He wanted that to be with Sarah. That was his plan. But Abraham thought, and Sarah thought, well, I can't do this, we can't do this, so we'll do it another way, we'll do it our own way. And it did nothing but wreak havoc from then until now. Let me tell you, the Ishmaelites, which would be the Arab nations, including the Islam nations, and the Israelites, that's Israel, the Jews, they're still fighting. It's been 4,000 years and they're still fighting. Let me tell you, when we go against God's word and against His plan, we make trouble. And that's what Abraham did here. We see this one verse when Abraham had a son by Hagar named Ishmael. Chapter 17, verse number 10. This is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man child among you shall be circumcised. Again, a covenant is being made here, and there has to be a token. There has to be a sign of the covenant, just like with the rainbow in the cloud. This covenant, circumcision, is of all the males. All the males shall be circumcised. That's going to be the sign of the covenant between Abraham and God, and between his children and God, and on down all through their generations. Chapter 18, verse 10. And he said, I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life. And lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And Sarah heard it in the tent door which was behind him. He basically says, I'm going to turn around, I'm going to come back this time next year, and you're going to have a son. God makes the promise. Chapter 19. And he wasn't talking about Ishmael, because Ishmael was already born. Okay? So God's saying, you're going to have another son. Chapter 19, verse 32. If you want to believe that living in a hostile environment won't corrupt your kids, you can go ahead and believe that, but it ain't true. To be loose with grammar, it ain't true. Lot, his wife, his children, verse 32, after they had left Sodom and Gomorrah, here are his daughters speaking to one another. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. It is tough to keep your children in the right way when you're living with people that don't care. It's hard. We need to take every opportunity we can to protect them from this kind of thing. They apparently must have learned this somewhere. I doubt Lot taught them to do this, but they learned it somewhere in that society they were living in. Chapter 20, verse 6. And God said unto him in a dream, Yea, I know that thou didst this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me, therefore suffered I thee not to touch her. This is after Abraham and Sarah had lied about being husband and wife and said, no, we're brother and sister. Abimelech had taken her, was going to make her his wife. And God came to him in this dream and warned him. Notice here, Abimelech was about to do something he didn't even know it was wrong, but it would have been a sin if he'd have done it anyway. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. It wasn't then, and it's not now. It didn't matter that Abimelech didn't know she was married to someone else. That wasn't the point. So we have to understand that. We can expect that kind of thing. Chapter 21, verse 5. What did God say? This time next year you'll have a son. He was 99 years old. Verse 5 of chapter 21, and Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. God keeps his promises. God keeps his promises. If he says it's going to be a year, it's a year. If he says it's going to be a day, it's a day. And we might say, well, but God says a day is as a thousand years to him. Well, that may be true, but God also knows how we keep time. And if he says it's going to be a year, it's going to be a year. Of course, many times he doesn't say exactly how long. Remember the other promise. Your children will sojourn in the land 400 years. In the fourth generation, they'll come back up out of that land. You'll see those same things being brought to bear later on. Chapter 22. That in blessing I will bless thee. This is God speaking to Abraham again. And in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemy. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because thou hast obeyed my voice. You want to get blessings from God? Obey him. We talk about Abraham's great faith. And he did have great faith. But at the same time, his faith was shown in his actions that he obeyed God. Chapter 23, verse 2. And Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, the same as Hebron in the land of Canaan, and Abram came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. When a loved one dies, it's okay to cry. Abraham mourned for Sarah and he wept. He loved her. When he lost her, he was deeply sad by that. Looks like we're going to get about halfway through. 24 and 25, and we'll stop. Chapter 24, verses 17, 18, and 19. The servant has just prayed, asked God for a few things to occur. And the servant ran to meet her. This is Rebecca. It sounds familiar, it should. And he said, let me, I pray thee, drink a little water of thy pitcher. And she said, drink, my Lord. And she hasted and let down the pitcher upon her hand and gave him drink. And when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw water for thy camels also until they have done drinking. That's exactly what he prayed to God would happen. The exact exchange of words. He said, Lord, when this happens, and when she says this, and I say this, and she says this, let that be the one. God answers prayer. God answers prayer. And he still does that today. This was a long chapter there, and I could have picked a couple more verses out of that easily. But I'm trying to control myself here. Chapter 25, verse 34, we'll end with this one. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Here Esau sells his birthright. Abraham was a wealthy man. I mean, flocks and herds and money and servants and, oh, wealthy man. Two-thirds of that was going to be Esau's. Esau says, I'll sell you a third of it. He was still going to receive a third, but he gave up his extra portion. There were two children, so it got divided in thirds. They each got one portion, and the oldest would get a second. So he could have had two-thirds of all of that wealth. He gave up a third of it for a bowl of soup and some bread. That's what you call nearsighted. Couldn't see past the end of his nose. Didn't even think about it. And the Bible says he despised his birthright. You'd have to despise something pretty much to sell something of that great a value, not to mention what you're saying to your father about what you think about him. But to sell that for a bowl of soup? His father had enough. He could have bought 50 million gallons of soup, probably. And yet he was willing to sell that all the way for one bowl. And a little bit of bread. Some bread stew. And that, incidentally, is where Esau gets his name Edom, which means red, because of that red stew. Red stew, is it? That'll stick with you when you do something foolish like that. Think about it. If you're here tonight as a Christian, have you despised your birthright? As Christians, we have a birthright. Special relationship with God because of the death of His Son. We have all of these blessings. But the question is, are we taking full advantage of those blessings, or are we, like Esau, despising that birthright? We have the right to go to God in prayer, but there are some that despise that and don't ever pray. We have the right and the blessing of being able to study God's Word, but some of us despise that. We don't ever open the book. Esau despised his birthright. Be sure we don't make the same mistake Esau made. Jacob realized how important it was. Jacob could have been the kind brother and just said, "Okay, Esau, I know you're hungry. Here, have some soup." But Jacob did what in our society is called price gouging, and if he did it now, he'd probably get arrested for it. He said, "I'll give you this bowl of soup if..." He realized the significance, though, of that birthright. He realized the value of that birthright Esau did. Do we realize the value of our relationship with God? If you're here tonight and you have a need to respond to the invitation, you need to correct your relationship with God. I ask that you do so as we stand and as we sing.